there was something happening in this community that was not normal.
Ketchikan grapples with a high suicide rate. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 12th of May. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the largest mammal on Earth makes a comeback in Alaska.
They can hear each other a tremendous distance away, and so I think that once the path is established, then it becomes a stampede.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Alaska Communications Systems, serving Alaskans across the state with vital telecommunications since before statehood. ACS, providing voice and high-speed broadband solutions, connects Alaska to the rest of the world. And by EcoTrust, working to encourage economic development, healthy communities, and healthy salmon in the Copper River watershed. On the web at ecotrust.org/copper river.
Mental health experts estimate there has been, on average, one suicide a month in Ketchikan since the beginning of the year. As KRBD's Deanna Garrison reports, a mental health provider in the city is attempting to reverse that trend by holding a suicide prevention town hall meeting tonight.
The National Institute of Mental Health estimates there are approximately 11 suicides per 100,000 people in the U.S. each year. In recent months, Ketchikan has been averaging one suicide per month, with another 3 to 4 attempted suicides on top of that. According to Gateway Center for Human Services, Ketchikan's main mental health provider. Gateway psychologist Catherine Pacey says the Centers for Disease Control would define what is happening in Ketchikan as a suicide cluster.
Suicide clusters are thought to occur two different ways. One is in response to suicides, and one is in response to traumatic death. So, you know, in sort of like a domino effect. One thing leads to another.
Gateway Board Chairperson Nancy Teagy says the rate of suicides in recent months caught the attention of the Gateway Board.
Several months ago, sort of got on the radar of the board that there was something happening in this community that was not normal.
Teagy says suicides have been reported in various age groups in Ketchikan.
Our community right now is, well, we're feeling it in the teen area. It's more, we're having it everywhere. So in all generations, all walks of life.
Concern over the suicide rate caused Gateway to organize a suicide prevention town hall meeting. Pacey says Gateway has 4 goals that it is looking to accomplish with the town hall.
One is to identify that we are experiencing what can be defined as a suicide cluster. The second is that we raise awareness for suicide prevention. The third is that we create a task force to address suicide prevention in our area. And the fourth is that the goal tonight is to raise community awareness and to help the community join together to become a part of the solution for suicide prevention measures.
The CDC says people are at particular risk of suicide if they have friends or relatives who have committed suicide. They in the past have attempted suicide. They have a history of mental illness, particularly bouts with depression, or they have a limited support network. Those risk factors can be compounded by recent trauma, fights with significant others, or major changes in life circumstances. The Suicide Town Hall will be held tonight at 6 o'clock at the Ted Ferry Civic Center. In Ketchikan, I'm Deanna Garrison.
The Royal Caribbean cruise ship Serenade of the Seas is now docked at Sitka. The vessel left Washington State with a crew member who had tested in Seattle for a probable case of H1N1, the so-called swine flu virus. All crew and passengers are healthy. The crew member took antivirals and tested negative in Ketchikan. But what procedure is in place if a ship comes into an Alaskan port with an outbreak of a virus such as H1N1? Dr. Jay Butler is the chief medical officer for Alaska. He says until a vessel reaches Alaska soil, the federal government is the only entity notified of ill patients.
In Alaska, you know, CDC is the agency of the federal government that receives those reports, and they are actually under no legal obligation to report those incidents to the state. However, there is now a quarantine station of the CDC located in Anchorage, and through just developing that relationship and our common interest in protecting health, we do, for the most part, receive those reports. And in the recent case of swine influenza, that's how we were notified of that event. And we're working on being able to make sure that we get the appropriate heads up when there's outbreaks of gastroenteritis in our attempts to control norovirus transmission also.
And it seems incredible that the CDC in that process doesn't have some sort of requirement to notify states if there's a vessel that has sick people on board. Does it become part of the process once the vessel enters a harbor or state waters?
Well, it's even not as simple as that, because what I've described is ships that are in interstate or international transit. For a ship that is only operating, say, within the state, the jurisdiction actually falls to the FDA and not to the CDC.
Has the CDC verified the emergency protocols that the state of Washington used to test the crew member that was aboard the Serenade of the Seas?
Not that I know of yet, Laurie. I do have to comment, though, it's probably a little bit moot, because more than 95% of the probable cases are confirming. So we certainly go under the assumption that this is most likely or was most likely an H1N1 infection.
Are there any updates that you've had today of significance as far as what we're seeing nationally and how this picture is starting to look as far as, what we'll be dealing with this virus in the next few months?
Well, the number of confirmed cases continues to increase, even though in some states they're not testing very aggressively anymore. They know that the virus is in the communities and is fairly widespread. I think two of the questions that will be of great interest in the next few months is what will happen during the summertime. Usually influenza does not transmit well during the summer months in the northern hemisphere. And really nobody knows if that's going to be the case with this new virus. So we'll certainly be watching the southern hemisphere very closely. The other unknown is there are really very few cases occurring among people older than 50, and particularly older than 65, which suggests that this virus could be related to something that was circulating in the first half of the 20th century, and older people may actually have some immunity to it.
Dr. Jay Butler is Alaska's chief medical officer. He says the CDC is working to confirm the new testing protocols that can identify the H1N1 strain. Tanana is the latest community to see high water as breakup continues on the Yukon River. National Weather Service hydrologist Ed Plum says an ice jam 50 miles downstream of Tanana is backing up the same wave of meltwater that hit Eagle last week.
The water levels began rising there overnight, and this morning started to come over bank and flood some of the low-lying areas. They've begun evacuating elders and children from the village.
Plum says floodwater is carrying ice into the village and that trees are reported down. Upstream, Yukon River communities already hit by flooding in recent days are facing major cleanup and repairs. Plum says Weather Service observers have gotten a look at the situation in Stevens Village.
Many of the houses did have water damage, water in them, and some of them are more severe, ones closer to the river. A few of them did have some ice damage from ice coming up over the bank. And the access roads to the airport, there were approximately two washouts to the road that leads up to the airport from Stevens Village.
Plum says power and phone service are out at Stevens Village. He says water levels have dropped significantly in the community. Many of the village's residents evacuated last week in anticipation of flooding. The breakup front on the Yukon River is now downstream between Tanana and Ruby. Governor Sarah Palin toured flood-damaged Eagle yesterday. Eagle residents are coping with large chunks of ice grounded in town during last week's record flood. Local resident John Borg says the ice is intermixed with buildings and poses a hazard.
Some of these buildings are sitting on ice, and they may sink gradually, and who knows which direction some of these slabs of ice might decide they're going to go.
Borg says it would require a major effort to clear a mile-and-a-half long stretch of heavy ice blocking the road between the city and the native village.
Ice is anywhere from 10 to 20 feet thick, piled up in huge chunks, and it spreads out across the road right away, so that trying to clear the road, there's no place to put where you're pushing because it's already blocked. It's just an ice field.
The state is pursuing an alternate access road to the village. Borg says community members, including some seasonal residents who are just arriving in town, are carefully entering damaged structures to retrieve belongings.
We have one fellow here who his main interest is finding his father's books. His parents are dead, and he has the property, and his dad had an extensive historic library, and that's his main concern right now, and what's going to happen with the buildings. One of them is right in the middle of a city street.
Borg says there's no easy solution, and recovery agencies and groups are doing a good job taking care of flood victims in the interim. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, bird lovers imitate their favorite feathered friends for a crowd.
I actually studied redneck grebes as my in my master's, so yeah, I do have Grebe Girl as my email name.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Rasmussen Foundation, partnering with Alaska's nonprofits and people to improve the quality of life throughout our state. Learn more at rasmussen.org. And by BP Alaska. BP, where training Alaska's future workforce is a priority.
Federal officials say the owners and operators of the Rock Creek Mine in Nome have agreed to pay more than $880,000 in a civil penalty to resolve violations of a stormwater discharge permit. The U.S. Justice Department and the Environmental Protection Agency announced the agreement today. According to court documents, Alaska Gold Company and its parent company, Nova Gold Resources Incorporated, violated their construction permit on multiple occasions between April 2007 through September 2008. Officials say the company discharged stormwater into Rock Creek, Lindblom Creek, and Glacier Creek in violation of state water quality standards. Interior Secretary Ken Salazar has asked the Justice Department for clarification on a recent court case that's halted development in Alaska's offshore waters. Last month, the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that the Bush administration did not conduct sufficient scientific and environmental analysis before holding oil and gas lease sales on the Outer Continental Shelf. Now the Interior Secretary is weighing in on how he hopes to move forward. APRN's Libby Casey reports.
Secretary Salazar asked the Justice Department today not to vacate lease sales that have already gone forward in Alaska's offshore waters. Last month's court decision canceled the Minerals Management Service's entire current five-year offshore development plan 2 years after lease sales began. It affects the Beaufort, Bering, and Chukchi Seas. Seven lease sales have already been completed, resulting in $10 billion in bonus bids for the government. Minerals Management Service spokesman Nicholas Pardee says Secretary Salazar is interpreting the court decision to mean he does not have to stop operations in Alaska.
The Minerals Management Service will continue to make decisions approving offshore exploration plans for existing leases issued under the current five-year program. But companies will be permitted to conduct ancillary activities but not engage in exploration on leases issued under the current five-year program.
That does not sit well with the groups that file the legal challenge. Peter Van Tine represents the native village of Point Hope and two environmental groups. He disagrees with Salazar's decision to move forward.
And that's a mistake in our view, and we'll certainly be expressing that to the court in the due course of the case here. And the reason it's a mistake is because in the Chukchi Sea, the sale 193 was one that was rushed through by the Bush administration to try and get those leases into industry's hands very quickly and before it left office.
The appeals court said the Interior Department did not do an adequate assessment of the impacts lease sales may have on marine mammals and the environment. So Secretary Salazar is also asking the court for clarification on how exactly to do a better environmental analysis. MMS spokesman Nicholas Pardee says the agency plans to move forward.
Looking to conduct sufficient scientific environmental analysis, looking to find information, more information about what they're expecting us to do for the future. So just looking for further clarification.
Attorney Peter Van Tine says he hopes a serious environmental assessment will lead Salazar to decide against pursuing lease sales. Van Tine says Salazar has pledged to make science his guide, and Van Tine thinks that bodes well for his client's cause.
He's come to Alaska and he's spoken to the native communities and the public in general, as well as the oil industry, and he's emphasized how important science is to him. And we think an objective look at the science on a level playing ground, though, will lead him to a far more informed decision than the Bush administration made.
The village of Point Hope and the environmental groups are concerned about the effect development will have on bowhead whales and other subsistence marine mammals. They also say there's not proven technology to clean up oil spills in icy water. In the past week, Alaska's congressional delegation sent letters to Secretary Salazar urging him to look for clarification on the court's ruling. The delegation wanted Salazar to push for the court's finding to not be retroactive, and he agreed with them. They also urged him to move forward on a new environmental analysis so lease sales could continue, and the secretary is doing just that. Senator Mark Begich's spokeswoman, Julie Haskett, says the senator wants to find out what the court needs to know in order to get the lease sales moving again.
There has been a significant amount of time and money invested in the OCS program in Alaska. This is part of the energy future of our state and our country, and we just didn't want this to linger out there to a point where the companies involved just can't make it a go anymore.
The American Petroleum Institute, which is the nation's largest organization representing the oil and gas industry, is seeking a rehearing of the appellate court decision on the offshore drilling plan. It's also asking the court not to vacate past lease sales. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
Blue whales appear to be reestablishing their migration route from California to the Gulf of Alaska. The endangered whales were decimated by commercial whalers until the practice became illegal in 1965. Scientists guess half the North Pacific population, or about 1,500 animals, are migrating north again. Jay Barlow is a marine mammal researcher in San Diego for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. He says he had his first inkling the whales had returned to the Gulf of Alaska during a cruise looking for humpback whales. The researchers spotted three blue whales where the animals hadn't been seen since the mid-60s.
We recognized this was significant. We got some photographs of the individuals that showed distinctive markings. And so we sent those photographs to our colleagues at Cascadia Research, who maintain a catalog of West Coast blue whales based on photographs. And they compared our photographs with their photographs, and they found that one of the individuals, in fact, was a whale that regularly was found feeding in California waters.
How decimated was the blue whale species as a result of commercial whaling?
Well, they got so rare that the whalers simply couldn't find them anymore. There really aren't any good estimates of how low blue whales got in the North Pacific. But it's fair to say that the eastern North Pacific population was in the low hundreds of animals at the end of whaling.
And what do you think's going on now? Why do you think the whales have established this migration route again?
I think, personally, it's mostly oceanographic change. I think that there were periods of time when their food, which is a krill, simply wasn't available to them for whatever reasons in the California area, and so out of desperation or curiosity, they started exploring further and further north, and they found once again that there were a lot of resources, krill resources, off of British Columbia and in the Gulf of Alaska. And they might have actually just forgotten that these resources existed because the cultural memory was lost and disturbed by whaling. And the few animals that remembered that these areas existed had been killed off by whaling and no longer knew that they, if they passed through the relatively low productive areas of Oregon and Washington, that they would once again get to higher productive areas as they went further north.
And so if there was no sort of institutional memory from older whales that were long-lived enough to remember these feeding grounds up here, how do you suppose they happened upon the route once again?
That's a curiosity. Blue whales can travel a tremendous distance if they travel in a straight line in a relatively short period of time. So the whales that I see here off of San Diego in early June could easily be in the Gulf of Alaska by early July. And so what I think probably happened is that just a few animals were sort of frustrated by the lack of food and set off on their own to see if they can do anything any better anywhere else and happened to discover these resources. And then I think that once the migratory path is established, then whales follow one another and can hear each other a tremendous distance away. And so I think that once the path is established, then it becomes a stampede.
Describe a blue whale. Are they quite large? How long do they normally live?
Blue whales, they're the largest animal on Earth, and as far as we can tell from the fossil record, the largest animal that ever existed on Earth. The West Coast whales grow to a total length of about 80 feet. In the Antarctic, they got a bit bigger, up to 100 feet. They're gargantuan in proportion, and when you see them on the water, you only see a small part of them at any one time. You'll see the blowhole appear first, and then you'll see what seems like acres and acres of back as the animal rolls and rolls and rolls, and then at the very end, you'll see its little tiny dorsal fin, which is only about 12 inches high, break the water. And then it'll arch even higher, and then the flukes sometimes come out of the water. So it's hard to even get an impression of how large the animal is when you're right next to it on the water, because you really can never see all of it at one time.
How significant is it, do you think, for an endangered species like the blue whale to reestablish a former migration route?
I think it's really important to the survival of the animal, because nature is quite variable in its very nature. So one feeding area, for instance, California, is not always going to be a good feeding area. And I think that the flexibility to exploit previously used feeding areas like Alaska are going to be critical to the survival of the species. It gives it flexibility to survive in times that are bad locally.
Jay Barlow is a biologist with NOAA.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo, with scheduled flights to 16 destinations throughout Alaska every week. Northern Air Cargo, building strong relationships with the communities they serve. And by Alaska Communication System, serving Alaskans across the state with vital telecommunications since before statehood. ACS, providing voice and high-speed broadband solutions, connects Alaska to the rest of the world.
Captain Mark Hamilton, the Coast Guard's commander for the Anchorage sector, has been temporarily relieved of his duties. The Coast Guard announced Monday that Hamilton was removed by Rear Admiral Arthur Brooks, commander of the 17th Coast Guard District. The Coast Guard cited alleged misconduct and a loss of confidence in Hamilton's ability to lead. The Coast Guard says an investigation will be conducted. At its conclusion, Brooks may recommend that Hamilton resume command or be permanently relieved of his duties. The Ketchumek Bay Shorebird Festival in Homer is one of the largest bird-watching gatherings in the state. But for those who might not be into birds, there are plenty of opportunities for fun of the people-watching variety. As KBBI's Casey Kelly reports, one of the more popular events is the annual bird call competition at the Salty Dog Saloon.
With every seat in the bar taken and nearly every table packed, Master of Ceremonies Dave Applin steps to the microphone to let the audience know that the competition will begin in 5 minutes.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages, this is it. You're in the right place. The third annual Salty Dog Bird Call Contest. A big round of applause! Stop it.
After briefly introducing the panel of judges, some of whom came from as far away as Florida and Wisconsin, Applin explains the rules. Each competitor fills out a card with their name and a list of what birds they're going to do and whether they want to be judged in the serious or not so serious category. When that's done, he asks the first contestant in the serious category to come to the front of the room. Jen Stenberg of Anchorage does the common loon.
One more time.
Ooh. Yeah!
Other birds in the serious competition include the murre, the black-billed magpie, the raven, and several types of owls. But it's the last contestant in this category, Tamra Zeller, who will go on to win. She does two birds, the redneck grebe, and the crowd favorite, a black-legged kittiwake.
All right.
Zeller later admits that she may have had an unfair advantage. Turns out she's a bird biologist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in Anchorage.
I actually studied redneck grebes as my in my master's, so they inspired me. And then, I do have grebe girl as my email name.
In the not-so-serious category, bird calls range from species that you might find in an actual bird guide, like the domestic turkey performed here by Homer resident Lisa Matlock, to those of the completely creative and made-up variety, like David Kaplan of Gainesville, Florida, and his version of the ghetto bird.
What happened to that boy? What happened to that boy? What happened to that boy?
Kaplan says he was planning to do the sandhill crane in the serious category, but after realizing that he couldn't actually do the crane's call, he switched categories and birds.
I thought a not-so-serious bird would be a ghetto bird. You know, ghetto bird is a helicopter flying over the ghetto, and there's this great song by a band called, I think, Clips, or a group Clips, that goes, brrrr, sounds like a bird. So I thought I'd put the two together, see what these guys think of it.
The judges must have thought highly of it, as Kaplan ends up taking home top prize in the not-so-serious category. Judge Will Meek says he tried to use strict criteria and the highest of standards in scoring each of the contestants.
The ones that were really good, you knew they were just right on target. The other ones, I just looked around and went with the crowd. If the crowd liked it, then I thought maybe it was worthy of a high score.
For their bird-calling skills and abilities, each of the winners walks away with a Salty Dog t-shirt or hoodie. Of course, you could say that everyone who went to the bird-call competition walked away a winner. In Homer, I'm Casey Kelly.
Governor Sarah Palin is set to publish a memoir with HarperCollins that will come out in spring 2010. Palin's book, currently untitled, will cover her personal and political life from her childhood in Alaska and last year's presidential campaign to her political beliefs and her family life, including the pregnancy of her teenage daughter, Bristol Palin, who gave birth in December to a baby boy, Trip. Financial terms were not disclosed, but Palin was widely expected to receive a multi-million dollar contract. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Deanna Garrison in Ketchikan, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Casey Kelly in Homer. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. Sooner or later, the H1N1 swine flu will come to Alaska. There are simple ways to avoid catching or spreading this or any virus. Wash your hands often with soap and water or use a waterless hand cleaner. Cough into your sleeve or into a tissue rather than your hands. Stay at home if you're sick and contact your health care provider. More information is available on the state website at pandemicflu.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the state of Alaska.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.